on one hand, it seems to me that because one system is leading to another, it kind of limits what could possibly happen. So there's certain limitations. But on the other hand, given enough time, other things could emerge. So where is the limit? Where is the potential? See, I'm not sure about that.
Well, the underlying schemes are both the condition for the emergence of new schemes, but also place limits on what can emerge.
Mm-hmm.
They do exist. And metaphysically, that will be potency as both the principle of finality and a limitation, or a principle of going beyond and yet limiting how far you can go beyond. It's true that the underlying schemes place limits on what can emerge, and they just do. Now, what were you thinking of? Like life emerging on the moon or something like that?
I guess what I was thinking of is that we see this limitation, perhaps because we see time as not being infinite. Because if time were really infinite, then technically you can conceive of the possibility of everything reversing back and starting something new. So it would be kind of more cyclical. I guess I was hung up more on the notion of time, because he says, when you were talking before about time being long, but what if time were not just long, but were infinite? Then technically all that could possibly happen would eventually happen.
I think that is right.
If time were infinite, anything, everything that could possibly happen would eventually.
But no, but why does it have to? Because probability is a construct.
Yeah.
Well, that was
because
it could
end.
And
once you
could
figure
it
out,
that would
one way. You could also figure things out probability too. So,
if time, that would be a
I'm not sure.
That's interesting.
So everything. We could determine everything systematically. Does that mean we can also use probability?
Now, you can have an infinite circle, but then there's no beginning
or
end. But you can conceive of infinity in terms of progression, or in terms of cyclical, or in terms of the cyclic existence, but that's different concepts. Both are infinite.
But you have to assume that something will happen, and it's going to happen.
I don't know.
There is the limitation, and the limitation is the well. This is jumping ahead to the very end of the next chapter.
Talking about more than
five, but
the
concrete intelligibility of space and of time. The concrete intelligibility of space is that it grounds the possibility of the simultaneous multiplicities that constitute a situation. But the thing that you were talking about, the concrete intelligibility of time, is that it grounds the possibility of successive realizations in accord with probabilities. So that's the concrete intelligibility of time. It grounds the possibility of successive realizations in accord with probabilities. And then this sentence, which I think is the final sentence of chapter 5, concrete extensions and durations, time, space and time, are the field or matter or potency in which emergent probability is the immanent form or intelligibility. So time is part of the potency of which emergent probability, this emergence of one series of schemes from another series of schemes from another series of schemes and so on, is the immanent form or intelligibility. Time is what enables that to happen. It's the potency for that to happen. But it also, space and time do put limits on what can emerge as well. So that's the point that you are making. Later on, he'll talk of potency. This is the first time he's using that metaphysical term. It won't come up again until chapter 15. As a tension of limitation and moving beyond. Potency is a tension of the two. It's a principle of limitation, but it's also potency also means potentiality, possibility. Okay. let's go back then to page 4 on the notes. I was just going, jumping ahead there to page 7, since that is the rest of our time. Number 15, not only events, but also schemes have a probability. I think that's been clear from what I've been saying up to this point. More precisely, there's a probability to the emergence. And now I should have added, there's a couple of words that you might want to write in here. But there's a probability to the emergence and a distinct probability to the survival of the scheme of recurrence. I want to make sure that those we grasp that those are distinct probabilities. There's a certain probability to the emergence of a scheme, and there's a distinct probability to the survival of a scheme of recurrence. How do we understand the probability of the emergence of a scheme? Think of the emergence of life in the universe. When the prior conditions, all of them, for the functioning of life, schemes now, life as schemes, not just a single instance of it, but the schemes of life, are satisfied. The probability of the combination of events constitutive of living schemes leaps. And Lonergan says, from a product of fractions to a sum of fractions. That has been called into question by people, that just that, what is in the square brackets there, by some probability, people who know probability theory. They say definitely it leaps, but they're not clear, they're not sure that it's from a product of fractions to a sum of fractions. Maybe each of you will be able to comment.
Well, no, it's probabilities don't necessarily behave that way. If I multiply them, if I multiply two numbers together that are less than one, I will always get a number that's less than one. If I add two numbers that are less than one, I won't necessarily get a number that's less than one. So, I mean, I can defy
that's
the
right.
laws of probability
that's
if
right.
I do that.
That's right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So that's why I put it in
yeah.
square brackets, because people who know this the mathematics of this better than I do question that they admit that yes they definitely leap the probability leaps, but whether that's the way to explain it is another question. And the probability of emergence for a scheme of recurrence consists, then Lonergan says, in the sum of the respective probabilities of all the events included in the scheme, and it arises as soon as the prior conditions for the functioning of the scheme are satisfied. Well, that's probably at least close to the intelligibility of it, but that sum is a question that is something that has been questioned. And then the probability of survival. A scheme tends to assure its own perpetuity. Think of schemes even in human living, economic schemes and schemes of the governance of the church, for instance. They tend to assure their own perpetuity. But the perpetuity is not necessary. The probability of survival of a scheme of recurrence is the probability of the non-occurrence of any of the events that would disrupt the scheme. Whoever thought when they elected a 77-year-old pope in 58, they probably thought that he's just going to keep these schemes going. And maybe say, open the windows. An event that disrupted the schemes. So the general notion, anyway, that's from a very human example, but it's the same intelligibility, the generalized to those. The general notion of emergent probability is thus outlined on page 145. The actual functioning of earlier schemes in the series fulfills the conditions for the possibility of the functioning of later schemes. So chemical schemes in a certain composition and distribution fulfilling the conditions for the functioning of living schemes. Living schemes at a certain level of complexity fulfilling the conditions for the emergence of the schemes of consciousness. As such conditions are fulfilled, the probability of the combination of the component events in a scheme jumps. What is probable sooner or later occurs, unless something systematically comes in to prevent it. I should be careful. When it occurs, a probability of emergence is replaced by a probability of survival. As long as the scheme survives, it is, in its turn, fulfilling conditions for the possibility of still later schemes in the series. So as long as life survives and becomes even more complex in the series of living schemes, it's fulfilling conditions for the possibility of emergence of consciousness, and so on. The potentialities of explanation contained in this notion are outlined through considerations of the significance of spatial concentration and distribution, absolute numbers, long intervals of time, selection, stability, and development. That's what he goes into. That's number 17 down to 24. So 17 down to 22. So first of all, then, spatial concentrations and distributions. Each later set of schemes, life, for instance, Q, becomes possible only where earlier schemes are already functioning. The chemical schemes in the kind of composition and distribution that is necessary for life to emerge. So the later schemes become possible only where the earlier schemes are already functioning. The most elementary schemes can occur anywhere. The second batch only where the first have been, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Not all possibilities will be actionable. Elementary schemes will not be as frequent as they could be, thus narrowing the possible basis for the second batch, etc. There's a succession of constrictions of the volumes of space in which later schemes will be found. Since the latest have the most conditions to be fulfilled, let's just think of intelligent life as perhaps the latest, has the most conditions to be fulfilled, their occurrence is limited to a relatively small number of places. So I said they think of the conditions that have to be satisfied for the emergence of life. Absolute numbers. Large numbers offset low probabilities. What occurs once on a million occasions is to be expected a million times on a million million occasions. The minimum probability pertains to the latest schemes, and the lower the probability of the last schemes of the condition series, say again, intelligent life, the greater must be the initial absolute numbers in which elementary schemes can be realized. The size of the universe is inversely proportional to the probability of its ultimate schemes of recurrence. Long intervals of time. Even the initial benefit of large numbers is lost by the successive narrowing of the basis for further developments, but long intervals of time compensate for that. Just as a million million simultaneous possibilities yield a million probable realizations whose probability is one in a million, so also a million million successive possibilities yield a million probable realizations under the same expectation. Selection. If the probability both of emergence and of survival is low, occurrence of schemes will be rare and fleeting. This is why, for instance, we may have had conceivable, though there may have been the emergence of rare and fleeting even schemes of life or of consciousness, but then vanished because the probability both of emergence and of survival was low. If both are high, occurrences will be common and enduring. If the probability of emergence is low, but that of endurance is high, the scheme is rare but enduring. And if the probability of emergence is high, that of endurance is low, the scheme is common but fleeting. Stability. The line of maximum stability would be of common and enduring schemes, the line of minimum stability of rare and fleeting schemes. And finally, development and conflicted stability. Schemes with high probabilities of survival tend to imprison materials in their own routines. Think of people with severe psychological difficulties, for instance, the high probability of survival of those imprisoning materials in their own routines. They provide a highly stable basis for later schemes, but they also tend to prevent the later schemes from emerging because they're so stable that they don't want to let anything further develop. This is resolved when the earlier conditioning schemes have a high probability of emergence, but a low probability of survival. Now, in the psychological terms, for instance, that we've been studying in the other course that I'm teaching, there is a need for an intervention from outside the scheme, okay, for a victimized scheme, for instance, to be broken open. Something has to come, has to be. You've got the scheme of, let's just say self-destructive patterns of behavior and thinking, and it's just round and round you go, so on and so forth. And there has to be. The only way a person can get out of that is if there is some kind of introduction from outside, from outside the one's own patterns, that enables one to perhaps, first of all, non-systematically glimpse that there might be another possibility. But then maybe that non-systematic glimpse becomes a series of glimpses that eventually emerges into a pattern of thinking or whatever that, that enables one to break the self-destructive patterns. But it has to come from outside the pattern. There's no resource within the pattern of their own thinking to break them out of it. I used the example in theology of dialectics and history of Paul Lefrere's teaching of the people in the peasant population in Brazil. Their own pattern of thinking was fatalistic. What he had to do as a teacher was to introduce gradually to them the possibility that there might be another way of organizing their lives, and that they could take, they really did not believe that they could take any control. He had to slowly lead them to glimpse the possibility that they could effectively take control of their economic and political situations. Outside the pattern is a scheme of self-destructive thinking. And you have to bring them to glimpse other possibilities. And those glimpses at first are just, you know, rare and fleeting. But maybe after a while they become more systematic. And that's what our own lives are, you know. And our own lives can be that way. We can be caught in self-destructive destructive schemes. We need to be given the glimpses of the other possibilities, and those glimpses will be fleeting and rare at first, but maybe after a while we catch on. Anyway, the summary on 147. The point we're endeavoring to make within the limits of our narrow premise is that the notion of emergent probability is explanatory. Intelligent inquiry aims at insight, but classical laws alone offer no insight into numbers, distributions, concentrations, time intervals, selectivity, uncertain stability, or development. On the contrary, they abstract from the instance, the place, the time, and the concrete conditions of actual functioning. Again, statistical laws, as a mere aggregate, affirm in various cases the ideal frequency of the occurrence of events. But they make no pretense of explaining why there are so many kinds of events or why each kind has the frequency attributed to it. To reach explanation on this level, it's necessary to effect a concrete synthesis of classical laws into a conditioned series of schemes of recurrence, chemical, biological, psychological, just to take a broad sweep of them and those. To establish that such schemes as combinations of events acquire first a probability of emergence and then a probability of survival through the realization of the condition series. And finally, to grasp that if such a series of schemes is being realized in accord with probabilities, then there is available a general principle that promises answers to questions about the reason for numbers and distributions, concentrations and time intervals, selectivity and uncertain stability, development and breakdown. To work out the answers pertains to the natural sciences, not to philosophy. To grasp that emergent probability is an explanatory idea is to know what is meant when our objective is characterized as a generic, relatively invariant, and incomplete account of the imminent intelligibility, the order, the design of the universe of our experience. It has been attempted to offer. Then the generic properties of that I didn't put in here because they're on pages 148 to 151, but I thought that we had covered each one of those already one by one, and so I didn't think it was necessary to go into that. So can I pause here? We'll pause if there are questions. Otherwise, we'll just continue.
ask or where there's more.
So this is this like an explanation of on a more abstract way what supposedly is going on when we have an insight?
This is okay, how is it related to that? This is two things. This is first of all his presentation of what kind of scientific worldview arises out of the kinds of insights that scientists have. So if you take the kinds of insights that scientists have, this is the kind of worldview that would emerge from the combination of those two generic types of insights, classical and statistical, complementary, it would be this. But there's another point that your question gives rise to, and that is that there is also the emergent probability of the schemes of insight itself.
Right.
And that's...
Because that's what these things are, because we're not talking about the world, we're talking about our knowledge of what we know, and this is what's happening when we know. We're trading schemes. I mean, the schemes don't have to really be reality. The schemes are the way we think about reality.
That's all he's saying so far.
Right,
the schemes are what... Well, they're what we know, but whether
what
we
know
is reality
right.
is a further question.
And so the way we... It's kind of like Wittgenstein or something. Like, you build up a structure, and then you get out to the next level, and you kick out the structure from below, and then you get up to the next one, and you kick out the structure from below, because something allows you to... You know, to come up with a new scheme.
Right.
You know.
But then there's also the probability of the emergence of your own insights. So
right,
insight
yeah.
into the new scheme. Or
so right. So that's exactly the intervention you're talking about on the personal level is changing those probabilities for the individual, because they can't change it for themselves if they're going to have that insight.
That's right. That's exactly what, and that's what Freire, for instance, was doing with the peasant population. He's changing the probability of their having insights that would enable them to govern their own lives. He changed the probability of that. And, well, at least that's what he was attempting. Probably did succeed in doing it because they threw him out of Brazil.
I found myself confused by the final sentence in 18. The size of the universe is inversely proportionate to the probability of its ultimate scheme of recurrence.
Yeah.
So I don't understand how it's inversely proportionate, because you think the bigger it was, the more likely it would be that schemes would recur. And also, what is an ultimate? Where are ultimate schemes?
Well, we don't know. You know,
we don't know the ultimate scheme.
Alone, we know when it's, you know, they keep emerging. So,
okay.
And it's, we have an expanding universe as well. But inversely proportionate, because those ultimate schemes at the time of the basic situation, those ultimate schemes had an extraordinarily low probability of emergence. And so the size of the is inversely proportionate to that, to that really low.
To the fact that it would ever occur in the first place.
Doesn't that kind of get to what your comments before class, Nadia, in the sense that if you have an infinitely large universe, then you have an infinitely minimal probability for the ultimate schemes of recurrence, because things will just keep going on.
Instead of repeating?
Instead of repeating.
Well, we don't have that. I mean, what... universe, well, I'm not 100% sure about exactly what the character of space is, but is it not agreed that we have an expanding universe?
Well, that's what I'm saying.
If it's expanding, then it's not infinite.
Well, if it's expanding, then it's not infinite.
It's expanding. Instead of having been expanded to infinity. Oh, I see.
So it's
got, but is the expanding itself a recurrence? To the fact that it keeps on doing it?
Probably. Although, I don't know enough about how to explain that to say too much more about it. But it's not infinite. I mean, if it's expanding, then it's got boundaries.
Mm.
And those are being constantly pushed up. Mm. Or whatever. That's true. The image there is not very good.
That's a very good question.
In fact, I don't think we can really deal with it on a limited image.
Yeah. What does it mean that have an ultimate scheme of recurrence?
Well, whatever that is, we don't know. We don't know what it is. Is intelligent life the ultimate scheme of recurrence?
The end.
We don't know that.
You mean the end? By ultimate, we talk about end.
The most highly developed.
Yeah.
Most
the
highly
end.
Developed.
The end. Because there isn't going to be another scheme of recurrence that will be more ultimate than this.
Okay, can we just try to finish the material that I put together on these notes and then we can take our break and you get reading week and then we get into stuff that is very different material. From section three, I just want to take only the following points. There's no way that I could go into Aristotle, Galileo, Darwin, and indeterminism in here. Darwin will come back in chapter 8 when one of them talks about the emergent probability of things. And so I think it's important to address the questions raised by Darwin. There's a lot of similarity and only one major difference between what Lonergan is saying and what Darwin is saying. It's the Galilean, what came out of Galileo was mechanist determinism, and that's a very different worldview from the worldview of, that Lonergan is presenting in this book. Galileo himself didn't recognize that the laws of nature were abstract, the laws that he discovered, and other laws that were building on the ones that he discovered. And so for him, those laws stood in the field of imaginable elements. The universality and the necessity of the laws were attached immediately to imaginable particles moving in an imaginable ether. And there followed from all of that a mechanistic view of the universe. So the laws were not abstractions from the concrete, but rather they were attached to images of the concrete. And so the universe was imagined, first of all, as a clockwork, a mechanistic view of the universe. There is some vast aggregate of discrete or continuous but imaginable elements. They are all subject to universal and necessary laws, and the business of the scientist is the hard task of determining those laws and so predicting what cannot but occur. The universe implicit in Galileo's methodology is an aggregate of imaginable parts, and each is related systematically to all the others. Apart from the universe of imaginable elements, there can arise no further imaginable interventions, and so the mechanism is also a determinism. But for Lonergan, abstraction is not impoverishing but enriching in the sense of enriching. In the sense of enriching abstraction, classical laws are abstract. A systematic unification of classical laws does not imply the possibility of imaginative synthesis of concrete realities. The concentration of systematic relationships in the abstract field leaves the further determinations needed for concrete applications non-systematically related to one another. And so at that point you break away from the mechanist determinist into a world of probability expectations. And finally, chapter 5 on space and time, I can only talk about two essential points in there with any understanding that is sufficient to allow me to comment. First of all, because I'm going to just erase this. Because all mathematical principles and all natural laws of the classical type are abstract, their appropriate expression must be invariant with variations of the place or time of the speaker. But physics investigates local movements and cannot state their laws without some reference to places and times. But then the laws contain an element that can vary with variations of the speaker's place and time, unless the physicist finds spatiotemporal invariants that enable invariant expressions of the laws of local motion. The key to finding transformation equations that enable expressions that do not change their meaning with shifts, transformation equations that enable expressions that do not change their meaning with shifts of reference frame. Then the expressions will be invariant because they stand for abstract and generally valid propositions. These expressions will constitute a geometry, right? And this is the point of the abstract intelligibility of space and time will be found in that geometry, whatever it is, whose spatial and temporal principles and laws will remain invariant under transformations of reference frames. This will be the geometry or geometries verified by physicists in establishing the invariant formulations of their abstract principles and laws. So those geometries, that geometry or those geometries, are what give us the abstract intelligibility of space and time. In stating this, Lonergan is intent on correcting Newton's presumption that the absolute lies on the level of sensible particulars. We can go into that if we need to. But I want to cover the next point first. On the other hand, there's also a concrete intelligibility grasped in the totality of concrete extensions and durations that also is identical for all spatio-temporal viewpoints. And this is what I quoted with reference to Nadia's question. The concrete intelligibility of space is that it grounds the possibility of the simultaneous multiplicities that constitute a situation. The concrete intelligibility of time is that it grounds the possibility of successive realizations in accord with probabilities. Concrete extensions and concrete durations are the field or matter or potency in which emergent probability is the emergent form or intelligibility. So space and time concretely are the potency in which emergent probability is the form or the intelligibility. The concrete intelligibility of space and time is as that field or matter or potency in which emergent probability is the intelligibility immanent to the universe. So much for what I have to say on these chapters. We can just take the last few minutes just to see where we are with it. Chris?
Well, this comment that Dorothy made on that sentence, and that's got me...
The inverse
the size
universe of the
universe. Growing. So if the universe is growing, is it growing by these ultimate schemes?
No, he's not saying that it's growing. That was me. It's the expanding thing. He's just saying that the size of the universe is inversely proportionate to the probability of the ultimate schemes. That's a very generic statement. He's not saying what that probability is. He's not saying what those schemes are. He's not saying what that size is.
Right.
He's just saying that at the basic situation of the universe, the probabilities of whatever of the ultimate schemes are going to be was extremely low. And because of the significance of space, spatial distributions and so on, the size of the universe would be inversely proportionate to that, because the ultimate schemes can only be realized where the prior ones have been realized. And so you've got a successive constriction of the space in which those later schemes can be realized.
Right.
So that would affect the size. That's all he's saying. He's making a very generic statement about that. An inverse ratio between the probability of the later schemes, the ultimate schemes,
yes,
and the size of the universe. That's the only statement he's making. He's not claiming the universe is expanding or anything.
So by ultimate, he means last.
Last.
So where is this all going to end up? we can't know that.
We don't know that. Okay. We don't even know what the most developed schemes are. You know, I mean, we can say that in this universe of our experience, perhaps intelligent life might be, but you know, there's an awful lot of absurdity in intelligent life too, and the social surge and everything else. But anyway, it may be that the potential of intelligent life is probably there, but we have no idea what other spaces in the universe, what's going on. It might be way, way ahead of the schemes that we have in terms of complexification.
Yeah.
So, we just don't know.
Well, the reason that it confused me is because I tagged that sentence when I read it too, and the way I thought about it was that by just the logic of the statement, that if the bigger the universe, and the smaller the probability of its ultimate schemes, so that, thus, if the universe were infinite, then its ultimate schemes would be infinitely minimal. The probability of its ultimate schemes of recurrence would be infinitely minimal. And so what I took that to mean is that
to live in an infinite universe would mean that it is constantly going because you never get to its end. You never get to its ultimate scheme. So then for you to say that we live in a universe that's expanding so that it has defined boundaries, so then are you saying that...
But it would be the same thing. I mean, it's just saying, but doesn't that say that the eschaton never happens?
It does. And the eschaton doesn't happen in this. I mean, the eschaton is a totally different realm. Right?
There's no. Okay,
it's related.
There's no end of. Yeah, but I mean, the ultimate scheme. What is the ultimate scheme? But this, the end of time. I mean, there's
okay.
No end to time.
The eschaton is about something related but different.
Okay.
The new creation.
Am I misunderstanding?
You're not misunderstanding it at all. I don't think you are. I may have misled you by my talk about the expanding universe and the boundaries because I realized that I was bringing in images there that are not helpful. You know, I should have reflected before I spoke. And I should do that frequently. So I may have been misleading at that point. But I don't think I don't see, though, what...
Can you say that if the universe is infinitely large, then that it's the probability of its ultimate scheme of recurrence are infinitely minimal?
I don't know.
I mean, that would seem to follow the logic of his statement there.
But
the size of the universe
is inversely proportional.
Is inversely proportional
to the probability of its ultimate scheme.
Exactly.
That's his statement.
So what I thought is just, it's going, and it's going to keep going without an end if it's infinite. But if it's not infinite, then that means, again, this is as far as we're going to go. And this, now we're at the ultimate scheme of recurrence. And this is the pinnacle of creation.
I don't know whether science knows the answer to that.
Right, but I'm just saying, like...
I don't think it does.
No. But, that would describe the situation according to the logic of that statement.
That's probably true. I haven't thought of it that way, so I need a little more time to reflect on it, but I don't think you're misunderstanding it at all.
Well, I'm still curious about what it means for the universe to be expanding.
I think that's where we're at now. It's an expanding, but there's also many postulates that say that with the Big Bang, that prior to that, there was another universe and it collapsed, and that this ultimately will do the same thing. And of course, that's beyond us, because the latest estimates of the globe that we get from Hubble is about 15 billion light years, and I think that is...
Wow.
That's a lot of zeros.
That's a long time.
But that would make sense then, right? Because then this Big Bang would be the non-systematic occurrence or event within this other scheme of recurrence, and then it took off as a systematic divergence, which
and
would
then
be
then it comes together again
as this universe
collapses. But that's way beyond our timeline.
He's just talking about, as he says, the universe of our experience. So
but when you use the word emergence, that in itself, in life forms, if we take the practical example, it's taken millions and millions of years. And it's not like overnight, bang, we have a new life form. And we don't even see it in our own lifetime or even within history. We see that kind of change taking place. It's not one day here's this new thing. You know, it's very, very slow. So it's really not, it's emerging, but you have to take the duration into consideration as well.
That's the significance of long intervals of time.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yes, sir.
Is the last statement, concrete extension, concrete durations of the field of matter and potency, is that all they are? I mean, is that an insight that is a, do they define each other's? You know what I mean? Does that all define? Is that necessary?
All they are.
Yes. So is it? I don't know exactly how to
Yeah, I mean, I think I know what you're asking about.
Is that what they, or what concrete extension and concrete time is?
Yes.
Is that what it is? It's the imminent form for intelligibility.
It's the potency for emergence, for emergent probabilities.
So that's a definition.
Yeah. And they will be understood abstractly by the geometries that grasp the parameters of the space and of the extension and duration. That would be like Riemannian geometry.
Well, I think the point there is, I think the point that he was making is that Galileo or Newton's mistake was to assume that the abstract definition was really instantiated in the world,
right,
in the concrete
that is
notion.
That is,
but that's not, because any geometry, I mean, any whatever you consider to be invariant, I mean, Newton considered his invariance was really based on one big coordinate system in the universe, right? And then special relativity, what he tries to demonstrate, is based on a coordinate system that's moving, an inertial coordinate system that moves at a constant speed, and that gives you a different geometry and as you move closer to it. But it's more than geometry. It's also, it's space, time, matter, and energy. As you move closer to the speed of light, things become heavier, distance has become longer, or so it appears. And in general relativity, it's all the matter that's in the universe makes up the geometry, so light doesn't travel in straight lines. Light gets bent because there's masses in the universe. So it's the combination of space, time, matter, and energy, which becomes a philosophical system that's the basis of your physics. And they all sort of interrelate.
Okay.
But this is not, I mean, this doesn't look at the whole picture. I mean, this is looking at space and time, but it's not about physics, so it's not talking about matter and energy and how to go beyond that.
That's very helpful.
But
thank you.
But if you go beyond that, if you say that space, time, matter, and energy, that collection is not adequate, then, I mean, if you look at that as a whole, then there's, like, from a description of science, I mean, there's stuff that could potentially be missing, which gets cast in terms of this probabilities, the probabilities of emergence, that if there were more pieces to the puzzle, it might not be so non-deterministic, but I don't know.
Okay,
we'll see.
I see what you're saying. Okay. Thank you. All right, we are at the time. We have no class next week, and then we'll get to chapter 6. The functioning of intelligence, insight in everyday life. The examples of ready to hand.
Yes.